I really like having doctors that are partners, literally, like part owners of the business. So what benefits them benefits the entire platform, and your stakeholders are aligned and those conversations are pretty organic and easy.
Hi, my name is Amol Nirgodkar. I'm here with my co-host, AJ Peak, and welcome to Healthcare 100. Each week, we sit down with operators, investors, innovators behind the fastest growing MSOs and DSOs, and even health tech platforms to really unpack strategies, systems, and even capital structures that are driving real growth. And at the end of the discussion, we ask each of our panelists on how can they drive 100,000 of EBITDA growth immediately within their platforms. With that in mind, I'm delighted to welcome Mark Greenstein and Lee Feinberg to the show. And AJ, why don't you kick it off with the first question? The title is Procurement Mastery. How do you cut costs without cutting corners?
And as we get things kicked off, maybe Mark, just give us a little bit of your background.
Sure. Thanks, Amol. Thanks, AJ. Good to be with everybody today. Mark Greenstein. I'm in almost 10 years now at Heartland Dental. I lead our what we call our growth office, which is our footprint growth, as well as our supply chain, which we'll talk about today, and our relationships with the payers. Before joining Heartland, I was a management consultant for 25 years, and I was just curious if any of the stuff I was preaching worked. And I'll let others judge if the last 10 years from Heartland have shown that. But I'm very, very happy to be here with you guys today. I love dentistry. It's been the best decision of my life was to transition my career and to do so in dentistry and with Heartland.
Thank you, Mark. Lee?
Yes, I've been in dentistry for, I guess it's 15 years now. Long, long time. I've been in healthcare for most of my life, come from a family of healthcare. And I have an interesting road where, like, I actually was pre-med in college, and I never went back because I met my wife and fell into this path that I'm on now, which started with LASIK and ophthalmology and really from the office level, right? I consider myself an office person. I come from the front desk and managing a facility. And what made me want to get out of that was understanding the best ideas and the best people come from the field, and they come from the practices, and really wanting to do something in the vein of by the people, for the people. So I got my start in orthodontics with Great Expressions and was part of growing that to over 350 locations. And in 2017, I founded one with an awesome financial partner and sponsor called Mid-Atlantic Dental Partners. And we grew that to 240 locations and exited in June of 22. Most recently, I joined Advanced Dental Brands as the chief executive officer in January of 24, which is a smaller New England-based group. And the idea is to grow it and, you know, continue to do what I've done over the course of my career. So fortunate to have been part of two of the top five largest in the country at varying points in time. Nowhere near my friend Mark and what they have built at Heartland, but a wide array of experiences over the years. And I appreciate you guys inviting me here to talk about this.
And Mark, maybe for some of the larger groups that have joined Heartland or just in your walking the halls, talking to other founders of multi-site in dental, describe kind of the pain or challenges they've had in best practices in procurement. What are some of the big pain points you see when you come across those groups?
I think the biggest pain folks have is, how do I navigate achieving effective supply chain costs without stepping on the toes of the doctors, and doing so in a way where the doctors will align on a formulary? I think the formulary question and how to implement that and drive adoption over time is one that creates a lot of angst. And I think what we've worked on very heavily in the last decade here at Heartland is, and I think largely have achieved it, in fact, it almost doesn't come up anymore, is constructing a formulary by doctors for doctors that enough doctors will rally around and use that to drive efficiency and effectiveness in the cost structure. I believe our base stores are now somewhere between 2.3 and 2.4% supplies as a percentage of revenue, and have been for on a sustained basis. I think that's just been a lot of hard work over the last decade. It's more than scale. It's to the point I think you're raising, AJ, which is, how do you work with doctors to have them comfortable that they feel like, A, they're buying great solutions for their patients, they have choice, and their decision rights or their perspectives are being incorporated into the decision making. If they feel empowered, they feel like they're getting a good value and they're getting good quality. It's kind of the trifecta that you're after. And happy to talk some more about how we do that at Heartland and share that knowledge. But I would say sustainably, we're in the mid to lower twos and have been for some time. And you can attribute whatever you want to that to just be scale effects, because as we suggested, we are larger. I think a lot of it is really behavioral.
It's incredible. And Lee, I'm curious, you've worked with the one group acquisition, bigger groups. How many of them have done what Mark mentioned in a formulary? Any of them, it's sort of, you know, would you describe the pain similarly? Is that many people out there are having accomplished that on a formulary basis?
Yeah, you know, I'm an ops guy at heart. It's kind of what I do. I view this similarly to every other thing that I encounter. It's not about control. It's about collaboration. The most important asset, the one that you remove from the office and it no longer becomes a dental office, is the dentist. So I've always wanted to treat the doctors like partners. And what Mark said, bringing them into the decision-making, having whether it's a chief clinical officer or clinical advisory committee, but having the materials selected by peers is important. It's a difficult problem to solve because you have a wide array of dentists. You got people in their 70s and you got people that are fresh out of school. And generally, the way I've seen it, the vendors and the supply folks, they go into the schools and they put all of their stuff in there. So whatever school they're trained at, of which there's a ton, that's the material they like. That's the best material. That's what feels comfortable in their hands is what you'll hear them say more often than not, because that's what they're used to using. So getting people uniform can be difficult. We've partnered with solo practices. And at one point we partnered with 150 practices at the same time. And the supplies are kind of akin to the labs. You have zero control or leverage when you have 80 labs that you're paying on a monthly basis. And the same goes if you have a formulary that has 15,000 items. The ones that I've seen it get the best, somewhere around 1,000 to 1,500 SKUs on the formulary is achievable and realistic. And it's all about choice, right? You want options, not like this is the only thing that they use for this. This is the only thing that they use for this. But you got a lot of resources and the doctors that are partnered with you, new grads, as well as people that have been doing this for a long period of time, and getting them involved in whether it's town halls, monthly meetings, surveys, on what materials work best, what they like to use, and then letting them decide with their peers what they're going to use and why they're going to use it. That way, there's no conversation that I shouldn't be part of, right? This is all clinical. I don't care what you guys use. It's not my job to know what it does. It's not my job to tell you what it is. I can help you organize it, order it, get a leverage economy of scale, stuff like that we'll get into a little bit later. But I really want the doctors to be comfortable and happy with what they're doing, and I can help them do that regardless of the product. So I think collaboration is and involvement is really the key, and also understanding the why, right? Like I like to set out the conversation every time I've done it by like, hey guys, this is the conversation that we're having. This is why we're having it. And this is how it benefits you. And depending upon your model, I really like having doctors that are partners, literally, like part owners of the business. So what benefits them benefits the entire platform, and your stakeholders are aligned and those conversations are pretty organic and easy.
You know, I love what both you guys said about the behavioral component of doctors feeling that they still make decisions and they own obviously the clinical part of it. And part of what I see in the industry today, and obviously I have a lot of experience working with you guys at Heartland, is you guys are so solely focused on making sure that doctor is your number one customer. And doctor is where you are a doctor-focused organization. It's hard to do, especially in these new models that I've seen come about in the DSO world. They call them some different things now. But I think how important it is to get the expectations as you're affiliating with practices and getting that behavior psychology early on that, hey, we're going to work together to improve. But if everybody is literally doing their own thing constantly, it somehow doesn't create a lot of value. And we see that a lot in DSOs across the country right now, where there's just no value creation happening by aggregating EBITDA. And so how do you guys do this at scale so well? I'm just always amazed by it.
Well, the conversation
of doctors.
Well, Amal, your lens is a really helpful one, because why aren't you joining a DSO? most doctors would say, I want to be part of something bigger. I want to be part of something where I can take advantage of the education and the support. And most of them are coming because they're feeling so burdened with the cost increases and the lack of control, and they're working harder and making less. And when you unpack that, we call that their emotional treasure. It's a very easy conversation from there, because we have at Heartland 3,100 doctors that have together aligned around a formulary. And to Lee's point, it's not one, it's a couple of the key items. So there's choice. And then when you say, well, why are you coming to Heartland? Well, you guys are the biggest and you have a lot of doctors. And so they can't all be wrong. And I think they answer the question themselves, is that formulary could A, help me be more profitable, and B, that formulary, why can't I align with what a group of doctors who are using it every day at scale chose for the formulary? It wasn't Heartland that chose it. And the truth is, we didn't choose it. It was done by our clinical councils, and they are used by so many. Younger doctors coming out of school, and this is a tailwind, and younger associates inside of practices we might affiliate with, they are much more up the curve, and they understand that ultimately a dollar paid too much is simply a transfer of wealth from their pocket and the pocket of the group they're joining to the shareholders of the vendor. And sometimes we have that conversation. That conversation actually resonates quite well with doctors, because they realize, you ask, who's winning here? Say, well, maybe you should go buy Henry Schein's stock, because they're winning. They're winning. And you can have logical doctors or scientists, you can give them data. And we can show them in analyst reports and in calls, they talk about just raising price. So everybody's unique. You have to Sherlock, what is their emotional treasure? How do they think about it? A lot of times we'll ask doctors, so tell me how you're thinking about this. If it's a control decision, well, I need to be in control of this, then we have lots of choices. You are in control, and we make them a promise. Any doctor can always order anything they want. And if after they look at the options, they look at the ones, we have this brand called the Green Heart that we put on the ones that are vetted for the best quality and the best price, but we also have other options in an extended formulary. And if none of those options work, the doctor can fill out a form and they'll get whatever they want. We'll never say no. And what ends up happening, because you've given them all of the choices versus said, by giving them that last option of anywhere they want to go, they naturally feel they are in control, because every time they chose to go in the formulary, they made the choice not to go into the special order, because you gave them, it's just like when I used to tell my kids, don't touch that. If I said, yeah, you can touch it, you're going to get hurt, I had a much better shot of them not touching it. If I said, don't touch it, they're going to touch it. And so we actually do give all of our doctors every day any choice they want, but they naturally gravitate to the ones that we vet, as long as we keep, to Lee's point, telling them the why, the why, the why.
There's gold there in that behavioral choice, working with providers, that I might leverage in the future.
AJ, I would encourage the listeners to read a book called Nudge by Richard Thaler out of University of Chicago. He got him a Nobel Prize. But my boss, Pat, brought this to us probably 9 years ago. He had read it and he said, this is kind of it. We don't want to tell people what to do. We want to give them informed choices and steer them. And that was the start of our journey.
We've talked a lot about the trying to get behavioral choice down to and behavioral change to a formulary. As you think of, if you're both drop shipped into a new DSO, 50 locations, 100 locations, is getting the efficiency when you're doing supply chain management, is it by the formulary? Is it the tools you're using, negotiating better contracts, so economies of scale, or is it inventory control? Like, where in supply chain management are those sort of big levers? Is the juice worth the squeeze, if you will? And, what kind of tools, don't need to necessarily name the name of the tools, but kind of what are the tools that you guys use now? And kind of where's the biggest bang for your buck if you're to drop ship in and try to turn around their procurement program?
I think it's kind of a combination of a few of those things. And I keep labs separate from this, but it's really, I've been fortunate from being in this for so long at various sizes that I've made good relationships with various vendors and people in the industry. And for me, there's a big bifurcation between vendor and partner. And partners have truly been that for me across multiple platforms. And, you know, what I talk to them about is, hey, look, I know I had 240 offices, 300 offices, and I know I have like 5 offices and an IOU right now, but that's what the partnership is about. If you partner with me now, as we grow, we're both going to be benefiting. So I talk to my vendor partners. I'm a very big fan on procurement software and technology. I love technology, period. And, you know, the ability to not be exclusive to one vendor, but to load them all up in software and let the software pick. If the product is the same product, like for like, it's going to take that same product and it's going to give you the lowest price option from whichever vendor is doing it. So you create this dynamic where they're constantly, it's almost like a constant RFP, where they're rebidding themselves against each other and against individual products. And then, you know, one of the tried and true methods that I was trained on is the centralization of supply. A lot of the offices that you find, especially the solo sites, they like to outfit every operatory. So they have way more supply inventory than they need, and it just sits there. Some of it even expires. I make it, to me, it's akin to like a buffet, right? If I was going through a buffet, I would take everything that I need, I'd put it on my tray, and I'd go to my table and I'd eat. So when you have a central supply where the doctors or the assistants can get the supplies they need by procedure and those setups are already made for them, then it's brought into the operatory and you don't have 30 or 40 of whatever it is in each of the bins in all of the operatories, which you could have an office of 4 operatories. I've had offices in our platforms that had 70 operatories. Outfitting 70 operatories could be a large cost of inventory that's sitting there that you don't really need. So it's usually some combination of those three. And then the final one would be the more expensive items that you're going to use a lot of, you need to talk to your vendors about consignment so that it's not just sitting there, but you're being outfitted with it and you're being charged as you go. You use one, they backfill it, you get charged as you backfill it versus the expense of one, the initial order, and then two, it sitting there from your and being on your income statement and having to do, inventory quarterly or what have you. So those are a few of the things that I do when I first get drop shipped.
I haven't been drop shipped yet. I chose once and I'm still here, but I'm not going anywhere. So I'm never going to get hopefully drop shipped. But
you do acquire groups of said size. Well,
when we acquire, I think the way to, I can share what I did when I started at Heartland, that because I think that could be relevant to all of the listeners. The first thing I did within 30 days of joining Heartland is I called every vendor and I let them know we're going to go to RFP. And at that time, we were just about $1 billion of revenue and 725 offices. Today, we're 1,825 offices and just under $4 billion of revenue. But that was the first thing we did. And most of the vendors came back and they gave us a 5% price decrease to not go to RFP. So we knew that we had to go to RFP. It was just don't have to go right now. So we took the 5% though, pocketed that, and that was well more than $100,000. And we were off to the races. And we had that done within 60 days of me joining Heartland. And then we did do the RFP a year later and started to lease quaint. We specified in that RFP that we wanted a marketplace. So what we described is called a marketplace. And that is a key technology to have. And we asked our vendors to build it for us. They failed miserably. So we fired them and went to RFP again and said we got smarter and we built something called Dentura, which is a marketplace. And it is, we've had probably 5 years now of that use, and it's enabled the results I shared earlier. And we have a main supplier and we have both models that, we actually have 3 models that right now in our, that anybody of any reasonable size can achieve. One is we have a direct supplier for us at Henry Schein right now, and it's always going to be their business to lose. But we also are opportunistic. If somebody has supply or they are able to obtain something and they want to sell it through to us, we have in the marketplace the ability to add that and to do that overnight. And that can be helpful. And then we're always running a data analytics engine and we're making sure though we're not doing it too much because ultimately on some of the SKUs, you're using some SKUs to fund other SKUs and the partners have to make a profit. So we're and part of that data analytics is we're constantly slicing and dicing the analytics and the public reporting of all of our vendors and manufacturers. So we understand what they're going through because it has to be a long-term win-win. But we play both those games simultaneously. And then the third game we play is where we have product that we think sustainably we're going to want to have for a very long time. So a good example for us is we've been a long-time consumer of Dent Supply's endodontics products. Dent Supply, they bought Wave One. I forget what the name of the company, it was a subsidiary, they sell it direct. And we do direct negotiations with them, and then we just pay a pick, pack, and a ship fee. So we run all three of these models simultaneously, always aware of how to maintain the ecosystem. That keeps us plugged into the marketplace. So market intelligence is really critical if you want to do this over time. Doctors also, to our first point on behavior, they see this, not army, it's a handful of people. We don't have an army. Literally, it's a hand, five. They see, though, that these five people, because they're constantly in our chat rooms talking about the things they're doing, that seeing, so they can comfort over time that there is somebody who's living and breathing this on their behalf. And that itself burnishes the green hearts and burnishes the other things that we talked about behaviorally. So they don't feel like they're losing control. What they feel like is actually they joined something where they're actually having people fighting for them. And we navigated through COVID, where we never had a day without PPE. We navigated through all of the ups and downs of the last several years. But that's five, it's literally been five people, never more, that are running what is north of $150 million of annual spend. But Dentira is the key part of that. It's the marketplace. And I can't overestimate that. It's a simple play. No matter what model you run on any given day, it can come into the... Doctors have no idea where their stuff's going to come from. They just don't know. And they just, it's like going to Amazon. Sometimes you buy in and it's actually Amazon's the actual seller. Sometimes you buy in something and it's Procter & Gamble. You just don't know. That's the same kind of dynamic that we have. It saves their carts. It gives them, they create their own budgets and it tells them where they are against the budget that they created. If something's not in stock, it automatically pops up alternatives for them. It makes it easy. So choice, ease, multiple models, and don't tell them what to do. Always give them the out. If they want to do something different, I guarantee you 80% of the time or more, they'll choose wisely.
This episode of Healthcare 100 is brought to you by HealthWealth Capital. HealthWealth Capital helps accredited investors build generational wealth through investment opportunities in healthcare platforms and medical real estate. With deep industry insight and access to off-market deals, we make it possible to invest in one of the more recession-resistant sectors of the economy. To learn more and learn about our current offerings, please visit us at healthwealth.capital.
You know, we've talked a lot about supplies, but haven't talked about labs at all. And labs are interesting. The more conversations I have with folks both in the lab world and the DSO world, it's a challenge. And I'm going to ask you a question that, let's say you have a lab that's a preferred lab, and you've got the green flag and everything else, and they're good, high quality, do a great job. And somehow, you know, sometimes cancellations happen. Like the dentist decides to just choose a different lab because nobody really knows what's happening. Then they may get upset about a crown or maybe some of the stuff, and that the quality issue or whatever the problem they have with the lab never gets fed up into the organization. All of a sudden you have 50 doctors abandoning your preferred lab, and we don't even know what it is. So how do you really, as you've selected a lab and you know they're good quality and people are liking them, and how do you get everybody to like believe that, hey, if there is problems, we can solve them and proactively be ahead of that instead of them saying, oh, well, I don't like this, and then I'm going to switch to a lab that charges me $400 for a crown.
Labs are funny because they're in the exact same situation as dental assistants. Somebody's favorite dental assistant is somebody's least favorite dental assistant. And it's the same for the lab, right? And with the lab, it usually comes down to the techs that are working on their cases. Again, involvement and choice. I've been fortunate to partner with similar labs across multiple platforms, ones that service thousands upon thousands of locations, including some of the bigger guys in our group now, or in our industry now. And at least with me, with my, 300, 200 locations at each of the different stops. So we've always had good analytics in terms of understanding what the remake percentage is, right? Because there's an industry remake percentage. So you know what that is. You know when it's spread out. I had 2,200 team members at Mid-Atlantic and I don't know, 700, 800 dentists or something like that. And, you know, when you're introducing it to a new platform where you have 70 or 80 labs that are being used, it's confusing. And I always start with the why to the dentist, like, hey, this is a pain in the butt for finance, right? We got to pay 80 vendors and there's these mom and pop ones that are like, hey, where's the $5 you owe me when you're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on these other ones. So I'm fortunate to have the relationship with the CEO of some incredible labs. And they bring themselves in or their team in. They'll do complimentary cases so you can try the quality and see what you like. They're very advanced in terms of digital technology. So the turnaround time is usually significantly less because of the scale and concentration. You can leverage pricing. But most important is the experience. And when I go into a new relationship, I'll usually have specific techs allocated to my business, or at least a few of the doctors that are in my business, to make sure that they're taken care of and that they're serviced the appropriate way. And the conversation is, you know, doctor, you know, there is going to be a remake percentage. Maybe it's 1%, maybe it's 2% across the platform. Not everything is going to be perfect the same way that not every procedure they do is perfect. So if there is an issue, communication is important. Getting it corrected quickly is also important, but it's very easy to say, hey, we have 800 dentists using one of these three labs. You can hate this one. You can hate that one. If you hate all three, maybe there's more to the conversation that we should be having there, because they are literally doing thousands upon thousands of cases. And it's not just for our group. It's for all these other groups across the country. So it's really making sure that they understand the relationship there, the scope of the size of the clients that some of these labs serve and the quantity of cases. I'm a big guy on not outsourcing for a few reasons. One, I've seen it before. Every few years, articles pop up in the newspaper and patients are like, oh my God, they're sending my crowns to China. So people don't like that. Two, I like doing everything in the United States. I like it all being based here and I like being able to support the smaller labs or the larger labs that are homegrown and take care of everything domestically. Three, inevitably, there's some customs situation that pops up every few years that I've seen. Even before COVID, cases get stuck in customs. Patients get really upset. Dentists get really upset because they can't deliver them. Right around COVID, everything was shut down, right? And there was a lab that was in one of the groups that we partnered with that was based, that they outsourced. And the doctors liked them, right? It was a fine lab. It wasn't my favorite thing in the world because I didn't want to do it. But with COVID, as soon as it shut down, thankfully, I have these great lab relationships that I've talked about, because we had to change labs overnight for hundreds of locations because the product wasn't going to be coming from China. So I like to do it domestically. There's some great options here for the reasons that I outlined. And the dentists really prefer that too. They like knowing that it's made, you know, hey, you can get this and it's right out of Atlanta, Georgia, or it's Phoenix, Arizona, or it's Tampa, Florida. So that's a little loquacious and tangential, but I hope there's some good content in there for you.
We'd be remiss if not either of your guys' organizations. You know, you can't pick up a newspaper today without the tariff conversations, threat of tariffs. And is it being talked about in the hallways at your guys' place of moving the needle? Is it, you know, much ado about nothing? I'm just curious if either of your organizations have tried to get ahead of it, if one even could.
I've had zero issues with the labs for the reasons that I just outlined, because there is no tariff. So put that in the pro category. And I was proactive with the supplies, you know, like their margins are fine. If they come to me and they want me to supplement their margins more, we're going to go to RFP and we're going to have a problem. There's a lot of places we can get supplies from, but they are not going to be coming to me and expecting to pass that tariff on. My love language is blunt and transparent. So any of the vendors out there watching know this. And I'm not afraid to make the changes. My responsibility is to the doctors and to the people that are part of this organization and taking care of the organization. That's always what I'm going to be doing first. And I'm not going to wait for somebody to approach me. I'm kind of an offense, right? I went to Florida. We're in the SEC. We used to run the fun and gun and the spread option. So my strategy is generally offense versus defense.
Mark, being the size of organization you are, how do you guys think of this? You guys do, you know, macroeconomically move the needle. So yeah,
We're typically 20 to 50% of some of our vendors' revenues. It's a fascinating space, labs generally. When I joined Heartland, we had 900 labs for 700 offices. Now we have, I think, about 70%, 75% are across our five lab families, which are actually 80 independent labs, not independent, individual labs. So the way we tackled this, again, over many years, is first we digitized a lot, because the digital process actually takes away a good source of the complaints that doctors have. So, and once you go digital, you, unless you're a 33 or a 45 record, you don't go back to analog. This started the digital process by deploying intraoral scanners in every office. And in many offices, we have multiple of these. So I think we have in the footprint now over 2,500 of these intraoral. So all of our volume is being digitized. And we control on the scanners, we have which labs appear. And these five lab families actually have 80 labs across. So to the doctor, they have to choose one of 80. And most of them feel just fine that they can figure out 80. Now, when they go off of that, we then, why do they go off? Well, dentures is a big reason. And there's a good case to be made if you're doing dentures that with multiple fittings, the local servicing, getting it all right, that that local has value to play, because dentures, unfortunately, are up until for us this year, have been a largely analog process. Now, we just started digitizing the dentures, and we rolled it, we call it digital dentures. And now we're starting to see that demand for using a local lab go down. And a lot more doctors are coming into the fray to do dentures, and they're using the scanner, and they're having a lot of success with it. So we expect that that demand to be off of going off the formulary for labs is going to self-reduce. The other good reason is some folks do very, very complicated cases, very high-end cases. And there, in that situation, if they feel that taking impressions, working with the local guy to get the shading exactly right because they're charging $10,000, $20,000 for the case and that's their market, I think that's okay. Because overall, we've doing over 1 million crowns a year. Vast majority of that, of our bread and butter dentistry, is going through the lab network. And I think we've addressed that quite effectively. And we continue to drive the pricing down. Before we get to tariffs, I would say when we first installed this model about 5-6 years ago, we brought on a Chinese-based lab, a lab that had only one facility and it was in China. And they came in and they actually had a really good price. And a lot of our doctors said, hell no, I am not going to send my crowns to China. And they were more USA, pro-USA than I think people are with tariffs today. So, but we had it there. We kept it on. Today, that lab, we do almost $50 million a year with that one lab. And it is by far a factor of two. And on a volume basis, because of that pricing, probably more than a factor of two on the largest lab. And we literally did nothing but having the lab listed on the scanner. They earned that. They delivered great quality on time. People know it's coming from China at a great price. That lab has not asked for anything on tariffs. They are building a secondary facility. They have a facility in Costa Rica that they opened last year. Oh, and they're going to build something probably on the mainland here to protect themselves, but we haven't had to do anything on price there. We haven't had any tariffs. We haven't had a single product in any category be impacted by tariffs, whether it's labs or supplies or equipment at this point. We take a little bit of Louise perspective on this, but nobody's even asked yet. So one company is asking right now, and they won't get anywhere with it, to Louise's point, but we'll have to see how that plays out. But I think on the lab piece, digitizing the process, digitizing then the digital dentures, and you're having choice, same kind of nudge principle, has been enormously helpful. And we continue to look for additional lab families because they're dependent on us and we're dependent on them. We get it. And we all would be better off if we had more diversification. And so as good labs pop up who are willing to adopt our systems. Oh, very important point. We put in place a couple of doctors, as in two, who live and breathe to help doctors who are having high remake rates. They spend half the time supporting doctors on how to do good lab work. So when the doctors complain in our chat, oh, this lab is terrible, they actually go and they talk to the doctor, and 8 or 9 out of 10 times it's user error. It's the doctors aren't scanning well. They're not filling out the prescription form well. They're not giving the lab tech the instructions they need to be successful. And so we have doctor to doctor conversations to address everything that's in the control of the sending doctor. And then the second thing they do is they go out to each of the labs and they help the labs install their improve their digital processes. So we invest in the right technologies, get as digital as possible, helps them lower their cost structure, helps them improve their quality. And that works very, very well for the bread and butter business. And that's how we ended up with the digital dentures. That is a completely Heartland design process with in partnership with some labs. And we're really excited by the early promise of that.
I mean, this has been just unbelievable, actually. We've got $100,000 ideas already. But since that's the format of the show, we're going to ask you anyway. One or two, I mean, you've given 10 each, so I don't know how to ask that question again, but anything specific that DSOs, as they're struggling right now, everybody's struggling with lots of different things, marketing, in every area I see a lot of struggle throughout the industry. Some of it's macroeconomic driven because of consumer demand. But what is, from a procurement standpoint, labs or supplies, what's one big idea somebody can just take home today, implement it right away, that's going to drive immediate impact, like the one idea you had within 60 days. But, you know, that's not practical for a 20 location group that was 750 location. But just one idea that could just like take this, it's easy to implement, and it's going to drive a party.
You don't know what you don't know until you get into the external environment. It's my, and people in any size organization need to talk to, build relationships. I think you mentioned relationships that you've built over the years. And you will find solutions to your problems, and you will get other people's ideas on how you can help address your opportunities. I think that's the best advice I can give anybody. And you will find money. I'm no genius. And I came into Heartland, I knew nothing. I never spent a day in healthcare in my entire life. I was in asset management, as AJ knows, and mutual funds, that kind of stuff, credit cards. But just getting out there and talking to people, the first person I called before, when I was evaluating taking the job at Heartland, was I called AJ, because I knew nothing about this world. And he explained to me what he was doing with his dad. I think it's super important to just get out there and talk to Amal. You're a master of this. People should call you and just pick your brains. I don't know why you want me saying that. And reach out to other executives, and you will find the answers. You'll find a lot more than $100,000. Other than that, competitive threat. You always have to have competitive threat. I think you're doing all that advocating is spot on. Just put your problems on somebody else's back. I'm paying too much for this. Can somebody help me? I don't have enough diversification here. Can somebody help me? And you'd be surprised what will come back, and people and your doctors will appreciate your answer for them. They really will. And then form clinical councils, ask your doctors to help you solve the problems, be transparent. Guys, we can't keep affording to do this. We just can't. It's going to slow down our growth. We want to grow as a business. You joined us to grow. How could you help us? What are you willing to do? Bring them into the process, change management, start early, start broad.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of a few things, and I know we're going to be up on time, so I'll make it a little quick for you. I think from the supply standpoint, it's establishing your formulary. Like, you got to measure it, right? If you don't measure it, you can't manage it. So establish a formulary, centralize your supplies, and deploy the marketplace or some sort of procurement software. And what Mark said earlier too, you know, one of the biggest wastes of supplies, I remember in maybe 2013, hearing the percentage of dental offices that still had traditional radiography and being like super surprised, right? Because there's a lot of solo sites out there. And any of us that have partnered with solo sites over the years know that not all of them are the most upkept, right? You have like you have a radiograph from like 1940 tube head, and you've got a sterilizer, and sometimes you come across the day room developers and all this stuff. Get the impression material out of the office. The patient doesn't want it. It's expensive. And it's not necessary, and it delays your turnaround time on your procedures, right? So invest in the intraoral scanner and go digital. No more purchasing of impression material. Shave that shipment time out off of it. improve the communication between the lab and the provider. And that is a very simple thing. There's a capital investment that's required up front, depending on which one you go with. It's more expensive or less expensive. But I would recommend that along the same vein of everybody switching from digital radiography, the next step, the next iteration of that is everybody getting rid of the impression material. We have inflection points in this industry every few years. And after this one, the next one's going to be what happens with these labs is everybody starts to print everything in-house as the cost of that continues to come down and down and down. That's a topic for another day.
Just real quickly, we paid for our scanners in the impression material savings.
Absolutely.
And don't forget shipping costs. You don't have to ship it. You don't have to ship it digital. So that's about $10 right there. Every case, every crown.
I'm a walking testimonial to both of your recommendations. I literally did call Mark and I implemented what Lee mentioned far too late, but it saved us well over $1 million. And so those that are listening, I can speak with conviction that I did call for help. And thankfully, people like Mark and others were quite giving in the recommendations as they were today. So thank you guys both for adding all these pearls of wisdom. We're going to be showcasing their insights in further detail at the Dykema DSO conference on August 6th. So please join us.
Thank you so much, both.
Thanks for tuning into Healthcare 100. If you found today's episode valuable, be sure to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your network. For more insights, resources, and episodes, head on over to healthcare100podcast.com. Until next time, keep scaling smarter. You've got the playbook. Now go build the future of healthcare.